today.
The following is an interview with co-filmmakers Nelson Walker and Albert Maysles. I'm Kate Welch. Albert Maysles is a pioneer of direct cinema who, with his brother David Maysles, was one of the first to make non-fiction feature films where the drama of life unfolds as it is without scripts, sets, interviews, or narration. He was in Portland recently with co-filmmaker Nelson Walker. They're working on a documentary about the people who they meet on trains. It happened that in December, I was on the train from Chicago to Portland, the Empire Builder, at the same time as they were on the train filming. Albert Maysles accepted my invitation to come to KBOO, not in December, but on a return trip in January. That gave me some time to watch a few of his best-known films, like Salesman, Gimme Shelter, Grey Gardens, and The Beatles' first U.S. visit. He brought along co-filmmaker Nelson Walker, or maybe Nelson brought Al. Either way, it was a joy to be with them, sharing the mics in a small KBOO production room. I was so lucky to have the opportunity to ask a few questions and feel the Maysles' love. So stay tuned and find out what Albert Maysles and Nelson Walker are up to. Maybe we could start out by talking about what you are filming right now.
Yeah. Well, Nelson and I are co-filmmakers, and we're making this film of people that we meet on trains. It's a wonderful opportunity for people when they get on a train to meet people whom they otherwise would never have met. And strangers become friends. And those friends become friends to everybody that watches television. It's a wonderful way of bringing the whole world together so that we have ourselves, all of us, and we're on common ground with one another, even though we have differences.
When I met you, I'd heard of you, but I didn't really know much about what you did, but I was able to watch a few films since then and gotten a whole different picture about what goes on, and I'm really delighted to have you here. It's really exciting.
It's that amazing opportunity when you make a documentary to bring the world that much closer to viewers, to people, closer than you could if you try to recall a story. The story is what actually is happening as it's happening, and you might as well just be there.
And that's how it was.
Yeah.
You told me when we were on the train about being on the train in Russia on the Siberian Express.
That's right.
And as I did a little more research about who you are, I learned that you actually have a master's degree in psychology.
That's true.
And you were in Russia. Can you tell about what you were doing there?
Well, I started off as a psychologist. Got my degree and taught psychology at Boston University. The summer after my third year of teaching, I was in my mid-20s, I thought, wouldn't it be interesting to go to Russia? No one goes there, no one gets in. But then I had second thought, well, if I get in, maybe I can get into a mental hospital and film. And the people that I film will be friends and to Americans. What a wonderful thing that Russians will find themselves and Americans will find themselves on common ground with one another. No war. So off I went, and I met an American correspondent and explained to him my problem. He said, well, tomorrow I'm coming to this embassy function, reception, and I'll see if I can get you along. So he tried. He said, I couldn't get you a pass. But come along anyway. So when I got there, he showed his invitation, passed it along to me, and the KBG guys who were there noticed that and thought this was very funny, and they turned me in. Within minutes, I was talking to the top Soviet leaders, and one of them took a shine, I guess, to me, and called up and then came back to me and said, look, I've made a phone call. You're all set to call this phone number and you're in business. And that was it. Came home, made this film, Psychiatry in Russia, and it got shown on the local PBS station in Boston.
And when did your brother join in with the filming with you?
Several years later, we joined in, and we made a film about a New York City film producer, Joseph E. Levine, and it just continued from there. We made a film. One of our very best known and best films is called Salesman, about four door-to-door Bible salesmen.
I've watched it three times now.
Really?
Actually, it was the last thing I watched this morning.
It's funny you should say that, because I met Bill Moyers at a reception, and as I was walking up to him, he says, "I know who you are. I've seen Salesman 13 times."
Well, that was one of the things I found, is every time I watch one of your films, and I still have a lot more to go, but I've watched as much as I can get my hands on from the Multnomah County Library, and I always want to watch it again.
Well, that's, you know, because it's totally unpredictable what is going to happen, and you're going to film it. There are elements that are additional to what you had in mind that are always there, but they're relevant to what's going on. And so there's much more to it than just the film. People see the films over and over again and get that much more out of it.
And in Grey Gardens, there's always a new line I particularly like.
Like, let's see, "Come on in, we're not ready." That's my favorite.
That reminds me of Grey Gardens. How did it happen? Because I think that's fascinating. And take it away.
Yeah. Well, I got a call one day from Jackie's sister, Jackie Onassis' sister. And her boyfriend at that time was Peter Beard, the famous still photographer. And when she told him that she'd like to have a film made of her childhood, Peter said, "Well, you got to talk to the Maisels brothers." So she called us up, and we got together, and we went out to Grey Gardens because we were in the Hamptons anyway, where she was brought up. And we went to Grey Gardens because as we were filming, Edie called and said, "We're in trouble. The Board of Health is after us. We're going to be thrown out of the house. Can you help come and help us out?" So she turned to us and said, "I'm going over. Do you want to come along?" He said, "Oh, yeah." "And do you want to bring your camera?" "Oh, yeah." And so we started filming right away. And that's how we got started, with her talking to young Edie and helping out. And off we went 3 months later to make the film itself.
So in the Beatles, where you got a call and who are the Beatles?
A funny story. I got a call one day from Granada Television in England, which is one of the major networks, saying that the Beatles are arriving in New York the next day. Would you like to make a film of them? So I put my hand over the phone. I turned to my brother and I said, "Who are the Beatles? Are they any good?" He said, "Yeah, they're good." We both got on the phone, made the deal, rushed up to the airport in time to see the plane coming down. And somehow they were warned that we'd be coming. So we got into the limousine with them, accompanied them to the hotel, spent a lot of time with them day and night for the next week or so. And we had our film, first film of the Beatles, What's Happening, the Beatles in the USA.
Apple actually released that.
Yes.
In that commentary, you talk about how you've made these films and invest a lot of money in it, but then nobody wanted to show them.
Uh-huh.
So you went out and started making info commercials, and that's where the IBM film is playing at the Northwest Film Center and on the 1st of February,
right.
And that was originally an info commercial.
Yeah.
Is that what you call it, an info?
An industrial film, yeah. We could see that either we're going to get money, which is difficult to get because of the nature of the filming that we're doing. It's not that commercial itself. Well, the Beatles turned out to be commercial, but so much of what we did and would do in the future was a little more arcane than that. And we want to make films that come from our heart and not from the commercial necessity. So we pay for them from making television commercials and industrials. So we were free to make the films exactly the way we wanted to. And that's so important, that creative freedom.
So that's the film that is going to be seen in Portland in the 1st of February. It's the IBM Industrial.
Oh, it's going to be seen?
Yeah, I'm going to send you off with the copy of the Northwest Film Center's.
Okay.
So they're showing it here.
But this is a film I made a long time ago.
It is, isn't it?
I know it was a celebration, anniversary of IBM, whether it was the 25th year or the 50th year, I forget. But it was a good 25 years ago.
It was more than that. It was in the 60s.
Yeah.
Thank you.
This one?
Mm-hmm.
Could you read it?
Yeah, it says, in this IBM, a self-portrait, 1964. In this early Maisel's film, the filmmakers visit the corporate headquarters of then-burgeoning IBM, interviewing average workers, executives, and everyone in between. In the process, they reveal the inner workings of the newly christened technological age's frontier. In sharp contrast to current, more calculated modes of corporate self-presentation, the Maisels evoke an institution through everyday minutiae and the individual psychologies of its workers.
Yeah, so we made it in our style, which they appreciated. And, yeah.
You're listening to an interview with filmmakers Albert Maisels and Nelson Walker. I'm Kate Welch. I'm also interested in your cameras, and that's one of the things that I'm still stunned at how much I learned in a short time sitting on the train with you and having you take my camera and spin the dials. And it's really changed the way that I've been photographing,
yeah.
And I really appreciate that.
That's such a difficult thing to do. And millions of people are using these video cameras now. It's wonderful. I'm all for it.
You were filming with your brother.
Yes.
And you had this really cool camera that you made yourself.
Yes.
And now, are there three cameramen today? Nelson, you can speak up. Nelson Walker.
On the train, we have about 5 different cameras in various shapes and sizes, basically so that we can deal with all of the different shooting situations that you have on the train. The train is a really complicated place to shoot because of sound, because of changing lights. The train is constantly moving and you're getting the light coming through the windows. If you're a photographer, you know how difficult it is to photograph somebody in front of a window. And on a train, that's where you're shooting. So it's very challenging in terms of light and sound. So we actually brought a number of different types of cameras to be able to work in many different situations. In addition to that, it's actually socially can be very challenging because oftentimes people are in the coach section and they're relaxing. And as a filmmaker, you have to sort of find your way into their story. But where there are great challenges, there are great rewards. And there are so many amazing people on that train that it's just been such a joy to shoot.
What are some of the standout stories? Can you tell us about anything that's going to happen in this film?
In this film, what's so amazing about the train that we're riding on, which is the Empire Builder, it goes from Chicago to Portland and then also to Seattle, is that it's a train where there are just so many people whose lives are in transition. And so, you know, we've been filming with people who are going out to start new work in the oil fields in Williston. We're meeting people who are coming back home after spending 15 years away, people who are meeting old friends after many, many years. On that train, there's just a real density and breadth of story that, you know, the train, it's almost like a vessel for stories and for carrying people who are in important life moments. And those are really the things that the film will be made of.
And what's so strong about it is that there are many times when people are just talking to, they continue their conversation as it was before the camera. And it's all the more real for that reason. Interesting to get to people you wouldn't otherwise meet.
Yeah, just like Albert said, I think a core of the film is on a train, strangers can meet each other. And people from all different walks of life who might never otherwise meet in other places are in this space between stations, between one part of their life and another. And it's sort of this space in which two people can get together and safely share things with each other and really get to know each other. In our everyday lives, you know, we spend so much time hustling and bustling about, but seldom do we have the time to just sit with people for several hours at a time and really talk. In the midst of all of these important life moments, important stories, really sort of the way they will unfold is through the conversations between people who meet on trains and become friends. So not only are we getting these great stories, but we're also seeing a new story unfold between two people who may be meeting for the first time and a friendship growing out of that.
I think that we get some very profound stuff, especially since on the train, conversations envelop themselves in a kind of a safety, because you're in transit, you're between stations, you're not exactly put in one place, and you know it, but you are able to give your heart and soul to what's going on in your life.
And sometimes you don't even exchange names on the train, you just talk to people.
Yeah.
So are you doing any of the cinematography?
Both of us are.
We're both doing filming. One thing that's really important is that the space of the train and the culture of the train is something where we really don't want to be disruptive in terms of what's going on and what's happening on the train. And so we've been very careful about, like I said, we have five different cameras. We have a number of different camera people. But what we don't want to do is overwhelm the environment where there are, you know, five cameras rolling at one time in every place. We want people to be able to feel comfortable. This is their space that we're entering. It's not our space that we're setting up to film everywhere. So one thing we've been conscious about is just, you know, how much each of us are filming and in what situations we're filming. And so we aren't just indiscriminately rolling on everything.
All that we do, which is not really an interference, is to set the stage where they know that, well, it's for television, and give them the impression that we have some sort of kindness about ourselves. And they sense that and they feel comfortable. For that comfort zone, they're all the more ready to pour out their own hearts.
I noticed that in everything I've watched so far, that you have, I call it the Maisel's magnetism, but people talk to you, don't they?
Yeah, because they know that I'll be kind.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that your education in psychology impacted how?
It helps, because I don't have any inclination to do propaganda. It's the same attitude that you take as a scientist, whether it's psychology or chemistry, and that is, let's see what's going on, and we won't prejudice our results.
You worked those early years with your brother, and he did the audio, and you did the photography. And there's a photograph. It's on the liner notes of Salesman, and
not very much in focus.
Not very much in focus, but just the whole idea of...
Yeah. That's my camera, though. See that circular thing? That's the circular thing at the front of the camera. And that thing that just above the circle is the meter, the exposure meter.
Now, I thought that was you at first, but then what's this on your back? And that's why I thought it was like audio reels.
Yeah, that's the camera. That's the magazine. Compared to what we have now, it was not so good. It was only 10 minutes, but... other cameras at that time were only 3 minutes in film. This was, without going really big and heavy, we had 10 minutes. The camera itself was designed to be shot from the shoulder. One innovation that was so important that we did was it made it possible for the sound person to be separate from the camera person. The camera motor was at perfect speed, and the tape, because it stretched, it would be very hard to control the speed. The speed was fairly correct, not absolutely correct enough, but there was a signal put onto the tape which corrected its improper speed, so that made a perfectly parallel recording with the camera. And I had a few innovations that I don't think anyone else has ever copied. Had a mirror at the very front end of the camera, just by the beginning of the lens up front. And I could, as I'm filming, I could look at the mirror and see the aperture and change it without having put the camera down. And I also had a Spectra light meter, which I had it also way up front, and I could look at that and see what exposure I should be shooting at. So everything was done to make it so that I would be less of an interference in the situation. and more of just an interested witness.
And more mobile.
And more mobile, yeah. And it's all handheld, and if you look at salesmen, for example, there's not a single moment where you think, oh my goodness, it's not steady. It's totally steady. So you don't need a tripod. If you have a tripod, then people feel, oh, I can't move. I don't want to spoil that picture. It's another interference with the continuity of what's going on in their mind.
Nelson, how heavy is your camera?
It's only a few pounds. Right now we're actually shooting on HD cameras, actually a variety of different cameras. We have smaller cameras. We have smaller cameras for tighter situations. We have sort of medium-sized ones for when we're kind of shooting things on the go, and then we have a bigger camera where we're going to be shooting landscapes with both outside of the train and then on the train as we see the landscapes going by through the window.
The camera that I have weighs only 2 pounds. Maybe another pound for the microphone and such, but that's all. And very good image, and totally quiet, of course. And I think I can run as much as 8 hours without having to change tapes.
And they have shotgun mics on them?
Yeah.
Yeah. The sound on the train is particularly challenging because you have a lot of people speaking, especially in the observation car, a lot of people speaking around you. And then the train itself is just very loud. There's, you know, the noise of the train moving itself. There are fans going on. So sound has been one of the biggest challenges. So we're using a combination of shotgun microphones and also wireless microphones so that we can really get the best sound. I mean, the sound is, in many ways, more important than the image. It's something that's a lot harder to rectify in post-production than the image. So it's something that we have to be really attentive to.
Any news on what's going to happen with the train dock when it's going to be aired?
No, we're still not sure about what's going to happen with it, but we do know that we will be wrapping up with it later this year, and we will have news about it at some point soon. But yeah, for now, we're just trying to focus on the shooting and encountering as many amazing people as we can and getting the stories.
I could sit here and talk to you all day. Tell us what you're working on next. You know what? You told me on the train about little kids and old friends. And
oh yeah, people of odd ages are not represented much on television or other means of communication that we have. The elderly, and certainly kids under the age of 10. What about 6-year-old kids that are extremely communicative? They talk a lot. It's very interesting. There's a lot of wisdom there. Sometimes the expressions they use an older person wouldn't use, but very perceptive and tells a lot. So we're making a film of 6-year-old kids. We're finding them at schools. So I've already filmed about 20 kid combination, kids, one kid friend with the other, and just sit them down and see what they have to say to each other. I usually film maybe 2 or 3 hours, so I'm getting a lot of good stuff.
Is there a story unfolding that's a thread?
So far, there isn't a thread. That's something that I have to work on. With or without a thread, the power of what they're saying is stuff, it's so good in itself that we'll have to find some way to put it together so that it has a narrative. Maybe cutting it in such a fashion that we keep coming back to certain people, some of the kids.
I sure admire your passion for your work, and after all these years, you're still out there and doing it and loving it. It's obvious that you love it. Maybe you don't. If you don't, you're really a good faker.
Well, the word love is the key word. Loving it and sprinkling that love in the room so that people that you're filming are aware of the fact that you like what you're doing and you have a full respect for them, a love for them.
It was a very welcoming environment.
Thank you.
So, and thank you for being here on KABU. Is there anything else you'd like to add to our little piece?
If anyone has $1 million to give me for my extended train film, there's a train film I want to make where I go to half a dozen countries around the world, filming as I'm doing this one in America, but extending the eye of it to the whole world. That's one of my next projects.
Wow, Patagonia Express, huh?
Patagonia, Trans-Siberia. There's a train that goes from South Africa quite a ways up north, and it's called the Blue Train, and it's the fanciest train in the world. People have, each person has his or her own servant, own quarters, and so forth. That, in contrast to the poverty trains that carry people in India. Again, getting a fuller view of the people of the world.
Thank you.
Good.
You've been listening to an interview with co-filmmakers Nelson Walker and Albert Maysles. I'm Kate Welch.
Join us Friday, January 31st from 8 to 10 p.m. to celebrate the completion of the 2013 Artists in Residence program. Our 2013 artist, Marisa Anderson, will perform live as well as play the record she recorded during the residency in its entirety. She'll also guest DJ and we'll talk about the Artists in Residence experience. That's Marisa Anderson, live, Friday, January 31st from 8 to 10 p.m. here on your community radio station, KBOO Portland.
Years ago, four lads from Liverpool invaded America.
You say you will love me if I have to go. You'll be thinking of me. Somehow I will know.
Join KBOO February 7th from noon to 4 as we pay tribute to John, Paul, George, and Ringo.
Join KBOO at the Clinton Street Theater Tuesday, February 11th, 2014 at 7 p.m. for our monthly KBOO movie night.
Amanda! Amanda!
To celebrate the 24th anniversary of Nelson Mandela's release from prison in South Africa, KBOO's Africa Oye will present the powerful documentary film Amandla, A Revolution in Four-Part Harmony. Preceding the film will be a special short talk on the power of music in African society by Baba Wage Jakete, renowned artist and storyteller from Mali. That's Tuesday, February 11th at 7 p.m. Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO, Portland.
It's time for the KBOO News at Noon for Friday, January 31st. I'm Kristen Yount. Cafeteria manager of the Uinta Elementary School in Salt Lake City, Utah, and a district supervisor were put on suspension after school lunches were taken from children earlier this week. The story got national attention after parents were outraged that the food served to the children was confiscated from them because they had outstanding balances on their school lunch accounts. 32 children had their $2 lunches taken away. Notices were sent out on Monday of this week, apprising parents of the delinquent accounts. A district supervisor decided to take immediate action against the children well before what the district allows. Principals in the district are setting up accounts to cover children who have outstanding accounts moving forward. A coalition of organizations joined forces to deliver over 1 million petitions to the FCC to show support for restoring net neutrality. These groups included, among others, the ACLU, Avaaz, Common Cause, Move On, The Daily Cause, and Color of Change, a group created by African Americans that was formed after the Hurricane Katrina tragedy and the equally tragic way it was handled. Earlier this year, the Federal Communications Commission's open internet order was dissolved after a court decided that the FCC does not have the authority to implement neutrality, but the FCC could have jurisdiction when broadband is reclassified as telecommunications service. The coalitions maintain that net neutrality guards internet users' privacy and makes it unlawful for internet service providers to influence what information goes to and from the net. To read the letter, go to www.freepress.net. Today, a bill lowering mandatory sentencing was passed by the Senate Judiciary Committee with bipartisan support. Probes found that federal prison population has exponentially exploded by 800% in the last 34 years. It does not do away with mandatory sentencing. It does reduce mandatory sentences from 5, 10, and 20-year mandatory minimums to 2, 5, and 10 years. Also, the bill lets judges make the call to determine if a defendant poses a threat to their community before locking them away. In Portland, the sale of the Fremont Tank in Southwest Portland won't go through for 2 weeks, if at all. Renaissance Homes, the benefactor of the property sale, brokered by the City of Portland's Water Bureau, agreed to wait 2 weeks to close the deal on the property. The Multnomah Neighborhood Association has filed suit on Tuesday. Residents